It is a beautiful day for a podcast. Hey, my name is Michael Zervis, and I'd like to welcome you, our 2B loyal listeners, to the debut episode of the Colorati Cast, coming to you from Precision Color Solutions business headquarters in Westland, Michigan. Now, before we introduce our guests, who are standing by right in front of me, I figured I should tell you why this podcast exists. We've looked high and low for content on the ether that deals with the printing industry in general, and really we've come up short. There's just not a lot that touches upon the history, the technology, controversy, and the news in what's a massive $83 billion industry. So we figured we'd rustle up some mics, sit down, and start talking about it. So I personally come from the film industry, which might not intuitively be connected to printing, but you'd be surprised. For years, I've worked with graphic artists, creative directors, marketing agents, and technical specialists on movies and commercials. I thought after all this time, I really should know what goes on behind the scenes if I plan on continuing what I do. We really don't have a set format yet, this being our first episode, but I think after a couple of recordings, we'll have something to count on. But for now, I figured we'd just get right into it. I have here Chuck Spontelli, professor of visual communication technology at Bowling Green State University, and Bill Burkett, industry leader in printing and owner of Precision Color Solutions. How are you, gentlemen?
Hi, fine, thanks.
Very good.
Good. Thank you for joining us. So I do want to get right into it. You guys have a collective experience of, what, 50, 60 years in the industry? Between the two of you, maybe more?
A lot of years. Yeah, collectively a lot of years.
Collectively a lot of years.
Many years.
Yeah, myself, over 30. I think Bill's about the same. We're about the same age.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so you must have experienced quite a bit of change throughout the printing industry, throughout its transformation. It's changed quite a bit. A lot of technological advancements. I imagine this industry is really based on and really contingent upon a lot of advancements in technology.
Yeah. Yes. We've worked through what I would call the photomechanical era, right, where everything was done with film and chemistry,
yeah,
and mechanics, into, of course, the digital era, which is where we are now. I refer to them as the bad old days, the photomechanical era.
Yeah. So are you guys seeing a lot of challenges come about with this, you know, this brave new world of digital rather than film?
Well, the digital era has been with us for a few decades, so it's not that new. But what's changed is that a lot of the knowledge and the performing of work has shifted into other hands. As there used to be an entire industry called pre-press, which
yes.
Worked with designers and artists to prepare their ideas for printing, and that industry has largely disappeared, and the work that they used to do is now done by designers and creative people, or possibly by the printers
yeah.
that they use.
Yeah, kind of went downstream and upstream. Yeah.
It's fallen.
But pre-press as a business kind of disappeared.
About 10 years ago. So that's the change that occurred from the new technology as the computers and things got cheaper and cheaper and the software better and better. It enabled other parts of the process to take over that former industry.
Yeah. Right. So do you guys view that change as a good thing or a bad thing, or is it just a change?
Well, I think it's a change. I think it's, overall, I mean, the aggregate of it is a good thing because I think we can do better work a lot faster than we were able to do. From an educator point of view, this is Chuck from the from the university side of things.
Right.
And many of my students are designers. We're not a design program or a technical program,
but
we have design. And so it is, well, like it or not, right, forced many technical tools on the designer, you know, and forced them to have to think about things that they never used to have to think about. You know, it used to be just the design, and then it was always the printer's problem to produce this thing.
Right.
And today, like it or not, they have to deal with, you know, color issues and all kinds of other issues that they just weren't a part of their purview. I'll let Bill speak to that
as
well. Yes,
that's a good way to explain it, that the change overall has been favorable in the sense that work is done more efficiently. There's fewer parties involved, but it's forced the creative people to take on technical roles that they probably weren't expecting, and in a lot of cases really don't enjoy it all. So that's the way it seems.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of contraction in the business too. There's fewer people involved in printing and design, but it's been a necessary evolution due to the economics of it. So print is competing against other media, and it had to be that things were more efficient over time.
Right, the democratization of technology.
Yeah.
Everything seems to be in the hands of everyone, and everyone tries to be everything at once, but it's hard to be. It's hard to be a professional at every single avenue of that profession.
It is, and the creative people want to be thinking of concepts,
right?
And, are creative in an artistic sense, not involved in difficult technical things. And I'm not saying that to mean that they can't do those things, but there's usually a strong preference to work on the really creative stuff, and the other stuff is regarded as maybe drudgery or just something you have to
production.
Yeah,
that's the word I like.
Yeah,
they like to use.
So maybe that's a good way to put it. That if production, part of the production process has been forced on the creative staff, and they do it, but it's not their favorite work.
Right. Yeah. And some larger organizations, they actually, if they're big enough, they can have a staff of, we'll call them creative designers, for lack of a better term.
Okay, right.
And then production artist is a term I hear used sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so the creative designer would, they would do all the conceptualization and maybe meet with the client and account execs and those kinds of people and, come up with the overall concept. And once it's approved at some level, then it's given over to the production artist to actually create files that would be sometimes referred to as comps and things that eventually would get shown to the client and then eventually produced from their files. But so they leave the more creative people, with fewer of the technical tasks and leave that to the production artist, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. So in this change, there's been, in my view, a loss of knowledge, a loss of skill that used to exist in the pre-press industry.
And quality, probably.
Well, that could also be the case, depending on how you define that. But
yeah, sure.
There's there's knowledge that doesn't seem to have a place anymore in the existing processes. So the printers eager to keep the presses running, and they they have very minimal pre-press staffs. Some a printer that used to have 20 pre-press people, back in the 90s, now they have two or three.
Yeah, maybe. That's what I'd say, two.
Yeah,
that was the number I was.
and those people are just pushing files through, and they're not really doing the things that pre-press people did in earlier times.
Yeah. So now, many times, it depends on the situation, but many times, maybe most, is a client, a designer, will put an image, let's say a photo image, in a document.
Yeah.
And the document goes to the printer. And, you know, if it were being looked at by a real professional, you know, somebody might say, you know, that image could take a few tweaks, right? And however, you know, and under the current way of doing business, the prepress person, you know, it's like, well, the customer put the image in there, they, you know, they must like it enough, and nobody does anything to it. And whereas the, you know, and the finished piece looks okay, but, you know, if you wanted to be real discerning about it, somebody could have made a few tweaks to make it even look better. But,
yeah.
Again, the economics of it, et cetera.
Right, because printing is a very competitive business, so there's no time or no money to spend on making fine adjustments and twiddling with things.
Yeah. And if you were to suggest that to the client today, in most cases, the client would probably say, well, yeah, if you want to make those changes. But to say, well, no, I want to charge you for those. We don't want to pay that $100 an hour to our photographs. They're pretty good.
Yeah.
So we'd leave it at that. And that's kind of where a lot of business is today, I think.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that,
Bill? I would agree with that.
And Bill is the, you know, Bill is the entrepreneur here and the business person.
Right.
I've been in the printing business all my working career, but I'm on the educational side of the house now, and so I'll cede to him when it comes to economics.
Right. So let's talk about the specifically color work in regards to printing. Now, for me, color is so important when it comes to film. We do a lot of color matching and color grading. Let's say if we shoot something in the morning, we're trying to look like magic hour right before the sun's setting. We really have to do an extensive amount of work to make sure that it looks good because everyone has seen that sort of magic hour look. And we have to make sure that, it's going to be a little stylized, but we have to make sure it's exactly that sort of orangish, golden, nostalgic feel that everyone comes to know and love, commercial work as well as film work. So there's a really precise level of specificity that we have to enact when we're doing that sort of thing. And I imagine it's the same when you're dealing with your own printing work. So talk to me about the process of color matching and color grading in the printing world.
Well, you're describing, editorial color adjustments to your video, and that's also part of the still printing business, where a photographer will take a photo of a scene of the sunset, and it's not video, but we're trying to get those same kinds of effects, and that is a creative kind of adjustment. But if you're talking about matching color, that's really a different subject, because if you're trying to match, then you're not introducing your own opinion into that match. You're not saying, well, that tile looks a little greenish, let's just warm it up because we like warmer look better.
Right.
No, if the tile is greenish, then it ought to be reproduced as greenish, unless it's defective sample and you want to change it.
So we're talking about the difference between that sort of creative element and then the fidelity that you're just simply trying to replicate what we're seeing in one object to another object for whatever reason it might be.
Right.
Yeah. In a color course I teach, actually, one of the last assignments I have our students do, and we have labs there, and I tell them that this is the most difficult thing to do in color, and that's match the color.
Yeah.
I refer to it as a physical object.
Sure, sure.
And what I have them do, actually, is bring in, I tell them artwork, and I get all kinds of drawings or some paintings maybe that the students have done or their friends have done.
Yeah.
And and in most cases, they scan these things, and then we apply some technology because we're making scanner, because it's a technical program, so we're making scanner profiles and things. But so they get a pretty decent scan out of it, but just scanning an object and then when you hold the object next to the calibrated display, there's still a color adjustment to do. No scanner is going to render the color really of pretty much any object.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so then their goal for this particular assignment is to do color edits as they learn throughout the semester to see if they could, you know, the what kind, you know, the closest match they could possibly get to this physical object. And that's tough to do. And actually, one of the reasons that I'm here with Bill today, besides this podcast, is I brought some of my students' artwork up with me, and Bill has a process I guess we'll talk about on subsequent podcasts, but PCS capture or something like that. But he's come up with a capture system with no editing that is remarkably close to a color match of these physical objects, remarkably close. So what I'm doing is actually tomorrow I'll have lab with my students, and I'm bringing some prints back that were done here at Precision Color Solutions, and see how, you know, students are trying to match their own artwork, but
right,
I want to see how close they can get, you know, compared to what he did with his color capture system as well. So it's a fun exercise, and really teaches student, you know, gives an appreciation for how difficult it is to match color, and that's really the most difficult thing to do, I think, my opinion in color,
yeah,
is to match something.
Would you consider that there is a ultimately a right and wrong answer when it comes to, you know, matching something? Is there a verifiable perfect match between one or the other? Can we really identify that?
Well, there is a science called colorimetry, which is the measurement of color, and colorimetry is the basis for what's known as color management technology in printing and photography, and colorimetry, you know, does give us a way to objectively measure the color of things and to say, you know, that they're equal, or if they're not the same, then how different are they? You can compute color differences.
Yeah.
So there is some objectivity in color, but that is based on the science of colorimetry is actually based on experiments that people did matching things in a laboratory.
Yeah.
And so it all goes back to
how it's people all built see on color.
The eye functions and how the brain functions, processing whatever, you know, comes from the eyes. So it does have its human element, but statistically, you know, it's been found that color, that people's color vision is fairly consistent, and the science of colorimetry is based on statistical averages of how people see color.
But in your business, Bill.
Yeah.
Okay, where you have two people viewing a color match, right? I'm sure you have many instances of two people looking at exactly the same thing, trying to match an object to a print,
right?
Or the print to the object, and two people are looking at it, and what do you see on occasion?
Well, sometimes you can see it differently, and that's... when you get to, you know, very, very tight color matching, where it's extremely critical, you may find that one person sees the match to be slightly off in one direction, the other person in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
You can actually
find
that
happen. They're looking at the same thing.
At the same time, they're standing next to each other looking at two things, and they see the match actually opposite.
Because in the color field, when you first start learning about color, they teach this triad, right? There's the light source. Right?
Yep.
There's the colored object,
right?
And then there's the person, you know, viewing this color object under this light source. Those three things. And what they tell you at the beginning of that is change any one of those, because color is a perception.
Perception,
right?
Yeah.
And change any one of those things, and the color has the potential to change, right? And that includes the observer, right? So take another observer there, and you could potentially have a different color sensation.
Yeah,
this is true.
Yeah.
So it's in the end, you know, color is a human experience, and there is some science, but it's built around the average person.
Yeah. And I think there's plenty of subjectivity there.
Yeah.
And Bill, dealing with clients, you know, most of his career, and especially if you deal with a client on a continuing basis, you start learning, you know, people have preferences for things.
It's true.
You agree with that?
I would agree.
Yeah.
And or they have biases. They tend to lean this way or that.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're doing work for a person like that, well, you know, and you're trying to satisfy their, you know, their needs and wants, then of course you play to those biases.
Right. Right. Let me follow that thread, because I want to ask you, Bill, have you ever had an experience that was just, you know, incredibly challenging experience with either, you know, a client or a particular order that you had, or where things weren't just working out? How did you solve that issue? What were the challenges and how did you overcome them?
Probably lots of them.
I know. Probably a lot of them. So you may have to dig deep.
Yeah, I've worked in color reproduction since the mid 70s.
Yeah.
So I have about 40 years of experience doing this, and you know, starting with the photographic film-based methods that Chuck described, and you know, through all the stages of electronic imaging and all the way up to today, where we have color management and color measurement tools. So the nature of those experiences has changed over time, and it probably doesn't it wouldn't interest people to know what was going on many years ago, but what goes on today, some of the most challenging things are when a group of people is your target audience. If you have, if you're working with a single person, then you can imagine that work would be pretty easy, because what they see is pretty consistent. But if you have a group of five people who all see things slightly differently, then you may get, you know, different opinions as to what is in front of them, and then you have to you know, work through the politics of that.
I was going to say, then you have to be a politician along with being a color expert.
Or it's not politics, but you know, and just dealing with people, hearing them out, and let them you know come to consensus on what is to be done.
Exactly.
But you know, those experiences are what really drove the effort, which I think we've succeeded at, to take the color matching process from the realm of subjective opinion and constant fiddling with things to make little changes, to get away from that and to rely on the science of colorimetry to achieve our matches. And that has cleared up a lot of those issues. But I would say that it's still potentially a problem if you have, you know, many people involved in color evaluations. If they if you have to please all of them, then that's going to be that can be hard to accomplish.
And probably what finally ends up happening is everybody gets pushed up against a deadline, and they go, okay, I guess that's good enough.
It's good enough.
becomes good enough.
Yeah.
or what other also happens, I mean, that is a way that this ends, if people can't agree. But another way is that, you know, some people have stronger opinions than others, and you'll see
the loudest one wins.
A certain person will kind of rise to the top, and they'll,
interesting.
They'll so convince the other
the
people.
The group dynamic.
Right, it's a group dynamic.
So Chuck, now when you're teaching this next generation of printing professionals and artists and color management specialists,
going into advertising and all kinds of crazy places,
what common threads are sort of popping up, things that maybe you find that you need to teach these kids that they might not already know about the industry, or maybe things that you feel like you need to teach them in order to be successful in the industry, you know, ahead of them?
Yeah, I think one of the kind of long term. I deal with a lot of technical detail, minutia that they probably just, you know, sometimes they do roll their eyes, but stuff that's important if you're a practitioner, but. Probably some of the big stuff they take with them is the subjectivity thing that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is it a subjective business? And a lot of them, some of the students get into photography and or you know, related
sort of fine arts, or
not fine arts, but related stuff where maybe they're buying photography. The preference thing that Bill talked about, right? You know, we talked about that a lot, the subjective nature, and also trying to pay attention to your, you know, because you want to give the client what they want, right, and pay attention to their preferences, and whether they happen to be your bias or not, that's, you know, they're paying the bill, and unless they want to do something that's really kind of maybe detrimental to their, they're really detrimental to their business or to the project at hand, you need to try to give them what they want, right, and kind of play to that bias, I guess. That's probably one of the things that comes up that would be like a long-term thing that's not going to change anytime soon. So
yeah. Well,
and of course the basic color theory of stuff is, you know, that they take with them. I call a mnemonic, I guess is the term, on the board. But yeah, when we say CMY, right, or CMYK, you know, we always use the letters in that term. You know, cyan, magenta, yellow. When we say RGB, we say RGB. Well,
right,
if you put those two things next to each other, the cyan next to the red and the magenta next to the green and the yellow next to the blue,
yep,
right, you have the complements with each other, and that simple little bit of color theory can help them in just, you know, all kinds of crazy situations, right? So
yeah,
dealing with clients and editing images and on and on and on it goes. Yeah. So it's some basic color theory that's easy to remember but very helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
That the average person isn't walking around with that kind of information.
Average or not, I'm starting to wish that I took your class then. I missed out right there.
Well, that's right. You video guys are always, editing color.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, you know, and I have some students that do video that come through my classes, and they talk about, you know, making, I guess we call continuity of scene. You know,
mm-hmm,
when you're cutting from one thing to another, especially if you're in the same space,
right,
you don't want that lighting, you know, that look to change.
Right.
So I guess there are people in video that deal with that issue.
We do.
Grading of color.
Oh, grading.
Grading color, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm probably switching my terminology. When I say color grading, you guys use different terminology, right?
Well, we have our own terminology.
Right.
Yeah. I refer to it as balance, I guess.
Yeah.
Color balancing.
Well, there's things that you do in printing to make images look compatible on a page.
Yeah,
right.
You know, so if you have six images on a page, you don't want them one to look real green, one to look real blue, and
right,
et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, similar ideas.
Yeah.
Certainly. Well, guys, I know that we could probably keep you here for another couple of hours talking about this industry, and I have a lot more questions to ask you, but it looks like we're running out of time, so we may have to cut this one short. But, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me and talking to me briefly about the printing industry. And I'm sure that we'll have you on very, very soon in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This is Michael Zervis signing off with the first episode of the Colorati Cast. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.